So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And today, it's what else would it be? It's all Apple. We're going to be talking about everything Apple showed off at their peak performance event. There was not much peeking, P-E-E-K-ing, going on, which is kind of a...
Yeah, it
is more of like actual peak, P-E-A-K performance.
Yeah.
Apple just kind of threw us for a loop there. But we'll be talking about all that stuff and some news from Google and other folks too. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget Podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's always super helpful. And you can join us Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Engadget YouTube channel, where we record a live stream of the show. So you can see it happening in action. You can talk with some folks. We do some live Q&A sometimes. It's always a fun time. So this week, it's Apple week. We've got news about a ton of new hardware from Apple. Not like, I don't know where you'd put this. This is like a B-level Apple event, because there is important stuff here, or some new products, but not like the stuff that will change most people's lives, you know. And we'll be talking about all that stuff. We've got the new iPhone SE. We've got the Mac Studio, the M1 Ultra chip, all that fun stuff. Sherlyn, you've already talked about this quite a bit on our like post-event recap. What is, you know, now that you've had a couple days with the news, what are your big takeaways so far?
I think what you said right off the bat was like, what a great way to describe it, right? Because it's not the event that unveiled the devices of everyone's dreams. So I feel like people were disappointed that there was no new MacBook Pro, no new like flagship level iPhone. This is definitely not the time of year for the iPhone 14, but
no,
people somehow
it's not the time of the year for new
it.
MacBook Pro either, right? Like, we just got new MacBook Pros in the fall, so you get a 14-inch and 16-inch, guys. Enjoy them.
The other thing is, as someone who like has been prepping Apple coverage ahead of the event and paying attention to some of the rumors, is that like, yeah, no, this time around, no one was really right on the money with everything. I mean, we more or less knew what to expect Apple to unveil in terms of product categories. We knew an iPhone SE was coming, but you know, the rumors were just conflicted as to what form it would take, whether it
would it be a new design? Would it be, would it be the 10R? Do you want to go over the other rumors, or do you just want to dive right into the SE? Because I feel like we've got a lot of thoughts about that.
What are your thoughts? I'm curious. Like,
I mean, it's fine. I think it's always good for Apple to have like an inexpensive phone. That's something we've talked about quite a bit. I'm a big fan of phones getting cheaper and more accessible. It is interesting that they're keeping the old style design, the Touch ID sensor is still there, which is personally, I think, is like, this is just a way to achieve budget. You know, like Apple has been building those cases for so long. They require like less demanding displays and like case design in general than the all glass iPhones, that they're cheaper to make. So that totally makes sense. I am surprised that they went ahead and just put the new mobile chip in there,
A15.
Right? The A15
Bionic
is in there, and that is pretty wild, because that chip debuted just a couple months ago. So it's wild to me that Apple is like putting the best mobile silicon it has in ostensibly a budget phone. Yeah.
This is something that's been Apple's strategy with the SE series for a little bit. I mean, you know, the last SE had the A13, which at that time was brand new-ish as well.
That was like 2 years ago, right? Yeah.
Yes, it was in 2020. The SE 2022, or the SE3, whichever way you prefer to call it. you know, I think it's sort of designed to last you longer than the usual iPhone cycle, I guess, because like, first of all, Apple only has released one every 2 years so far. But the other thing is, people who opt for a phone like this aren't likely to be dropping money all the time on a new phone to refresh it. And not that people who buy flagship phones do that either, but you know, people in this category maybe are a little bit more price conscious and less likely to upgrade every year. And so a future-proof phone is definitely important.
it's the more sensible option too. And I can imagine, I haven't looked at like deals from carriers, but this is one where I'm sure a lot of carriers would be like, hey, just switch to us. We'll give you this phone for free, right? It is so cheap that carriers can kind of like eat some of the cost of that and use it as a way to tempt people in. And that's good for Apple too, because it keeps people in the iPhone ecosystem. So kind of everybody wins. Are you disappointed that they didn't change the design or anything, Sherlyn?
One of my things coming out of this news was that I was like, oh, long live Touch ID. I love Touch ID. I think a fingerprint sensor has its place in a modern phone. Maybe its place is not below the screen, because that screen is still tiny as hell. It's a 4.7-inch HD screen. HD, 730p. What the crap? It's 2022. But anyway, I'm going to...
They can't make it too good. That's the other thing. Yeah.
The other specs on here are kind of strange, but I'll get to that in a little bit. I want to quickly touch on what you were talking about, which is like this being a cheap phone. I think that when you said that carriers, you know, will have a way to like toss this in as a free phone with a two-year plan, that sort of style, I think, you know, we also should be cognizant of the fact that like, obviously, carriers get deals from Apple on these phones, and they're not going to be $400 for the carriers. They're going to be a lot cheaper, too. But as at $429, the iPhone SE 2022 is $30 more expensive than last model,
right.
which Sam Rutherford on our recap show mentioned that phone, the $399 iPhone SE, was a little underpriced, actually.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, while I don't like that there's a price hike, I do appreciate that this is still like a sub 450 phone. The Pixel 5a costs 450. The Galaxy A52 5G, which is still the latest A series, it's a $500 phone. So I'm surprised Apple is undercutting on price.
For sure. I think the last one came as the pandemic was like just beginning to, like, I forget where exactly that landed. So like now they're facing more pressures in terms of like production and stuff too. So it makes sense that the price could get a little higher. Has the camera changed at all? I still see one camera in the back. I think the sensor or something would be better. Yeah.
No.
No?
It's a 12. Well, I have to look again at the specs, because I was comparing various different phones to each other last night. And the iPhone SE 2020 has a single rear 12-megapixel camera. Up front, there's a 7-megapixel camera for selfies. And I compared it, I think, with the last generation of iPhone SE, as well as this generation of the iPhone mini. So that was like mildly confusing to me. But the older iPhone SE had also a single rear 12 megapixel camera. So it does look like almost exactly the same hardware. I obviously would have to ask Apple to confirm if it's exactly the same hardware. But yeah, no, what Apple did say is improving on the photography side of things this year is the A15's ISP, and the newer processing enabling things like live text in your app, in your camera app, as well as things like photographic styles, deep fusion, smart HDR4, capabilities. So you'll see, I think, some improvement, but not a huge leap.
Like the computational side of things is probably better. That makes sense. You mentioned
it might be faster.
You mentioned the mini, Sherlyn. I feel like that is the iPhone family now is SE, mini, which is cheaper than the base 13, and then 13, then 13 Pro and Pro Max. What is the mini starting price? Is that $599?
The mini starts at, I believed it was $699, but let me double check it.
Yeah,
I'm not at that stage in my research yet.
That's definitely the mid-range pricing. I do wonder if like people are now thinking like, okay, I wanted something small, but I want a new design. Then you move up to the mini. Maybe that could be a thing for some people.
It could be. I think the mini is smaller physically in size, but it has a larger screen. It's got like a 5-inch screen. People I've spoken to, for them, the SE, and I'm sure for you too, right? Like if you have someone in your life that's like a dependent on you and then, you know, relies on you for their phone, but like you don't necessarily need to spend that much money on a phone for them and they don't need bells and whistles, then an SE is something that's pretty like a compelling option, because it's got a serviceable camera. It's got like not the best screen, but you know, who really needs a great screen? Unless of course, if you have like visual issues, like people who have low vision would benefit from a bigger screen. But at $429, this is just a good deal.
I'm thinking of like also like, I don't know, when my daughter is ready for a phone of her own. I don't know what year mm-hmm. that's going to be. But like, what would my price range be if she was like 10 years old or something and like she needed a phone for emergencies? Would it be this? Would it be the Mini? Because kids have small hands, too. So it's like, I don't know.
So the Mini, by the way, starts at $699 and the 13 itself starts at $799. So it is a jump of about $270.
But I think that's why we'll never see the SE get like a big design upgrade, because like the Mini, hey, you want a nice small phone with a new design and a slightly bigger screen, the Mini's right there.
Go get the Mini. The problem with these small phones is that like battery life remains a huge concern, and let's not forget the SE this year comes with 5G, and it's controversial because it's just sub 6 5G, which means it doesn't support millimeter wave, which means that Verizon was very happy.
That's fine.
I think I saw some tweets.
Who cares?
I don't think. Yeah.
Did you see some tweets from Verizon?
I saw some tweets from people who work at Verizon throwing shade.
Throwing shade. Was the shade only like accessible where you could see those people? Like, did you have to be in line of sight?
Line of sight.
If you're a building over, could you actually get that shade? I'm talking about your millimeter wave, Verizon. I
agree with that assessment, mm-hmm. Devendra, in the sense that like why go to the trouble of stuffing millimeter wave into a phone where not everyone has equal access and it's not as widely available or accessible? I was confused as to whether there was support for mid-band. And I spoke with Apple, and yeah, it does seem like there is actually going to be support for mid-band when that's ready,
that's great.
When those networks.
Sub-6 and mid-band is actually going to make people's lives better, so that's fantastic. Those rare instances where I'm in front of a millimeter wave tower, it is nice. It's like, wow, look at this thing I can do
when I'm standing in this spot. Right, I love millimeter wave when it works.
Yeah.
Right.
It's wild.
A couple questions that people were asking during our live recap too after Apple's event were around things like ultra wideband support and wireless charging. So the SE does wireless charge, but it does not have like the UWB chip for more precise Find My iPhone or AirTag tracking.
So
you can't really locate, you know, use the iPhone SE 2022 to locate a lost device in your home down to the nearest bookshelf, but
you can get a general proximity. You can get proximity and it makes a sound. Like it's probably fine for most people. I think, okay, that's it. It's an iPhone SE, folks. So you know, like if you want it or not, or if you're looking for a phone for your parents or somebody like who is not like super tech savvy, but you want them in the iOS ecosystem, that is kind of like where I see that fitting in. Is the iPad, the new iPad Air, I think that's maybe a little more interesting because now it has an M1 chip. It has hardware, or at least chip parity with the iPad Pro, which is always interesting. And it's still like, you know, a sleek 1 pound tablet. Starts at $699.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Comes in all these nice colors. Starts at 64 gigs of storage, which, by the way, the SE does too. Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh. I'm not a fan of that. Come on.
For that price, it's like I will automatically want to upgrade to the bigger storage. And then it's like, okay, that is, you're adding another $150 to that, device, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really
not
compelled,
a fan.
Though. Mm-hmm.
I'm not a fan of the low storage, but like, yeah, you're right. These are interesting machines. Go ahead.
I mean, we talked about this when the iPad Mini debuted in the fall, right? The iPad Mini, that is a talk about gadget lust, right? Like I saw that thing.
Man.
I was like, it's so cute. It is so adorable.
Oh, yeah.
It could be my everything device, my little like note-taking device. I could do a little typing on the side, but really it's just like consuming comics and stuff like that. Then we start to hear issues about like the screen, the like jelly scrolling effect on the screen.
Ooh,
and that made me think a little bit harder about it, but I'm still like enamored with that device. And now here's the Air, which is a little more expensive but has an M1 chip. You could get the cool like folio case and like actually use it for decent typing. So the practical side of me is like I should just get this eventually because I could do so much more with it. Where are you falling on this stuff?
Every time I look at an iPad Air or Pro in the last couple years, I've been just taken by how gorgeous they appear. The screen on the Pros are just lovely. Also, let's not forget Samsung just released the new Tab S8 series, which, by the way, just looks a lot like an iPad physically.
Yeah.
It's got that same thin metal build. Gorgeous.
You know, like when I'm thinking about like tablets and stuff, like, okay, which iPad and stuff, like that's like the Galaxy I'm thinking about. And like, The Galaxy Tab is over there on the other side of the universe. Really nice tablets. I still have like a Galaxy Tab S2 that I reviewed like when that thing was announced. And that still has a beautiful OLED screen. But Android, still not great for tablets.
We're getting there. We'll talk more about it in the later part of this show. But iPad OS, I mean, seems like it's getting okay. Here's a fun nugget. After each Apple event, one of my favorite things to do is go talk to my therapist about it.
I mean, Apple therapy seems like that's a good little podcast you got right there. Yeah.
That's happening. But my therapist, like, that's one of the companies he knows. I think he uses their products too. And he's like, oh, tell me more about what Apple did. And he himself was looking for a new iPad. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some confusion in like the general like public over which iPad is the, you know, iPad to get. And, you know, he's also been trying to use his iPad Air as a MacBook replacement because, you know, he was also longing for a new MacBook Air. And he just doesn't find iPad OS that useful. And I was like, oh, someone agrees with what we've been saying.
It depends on what you want, right? Like sometimes if I'm like, I just want to go somewhere and like write a feature I've been meaning to write for a while on Evernote or something, I don't want like all the crazy multitasking stuff and I could do and all the distractions from a PC, iPad is great. If you want if you want to just like juggle multiple apps at once and like be as productive as you can be on macOS or Windows, you're not going to get that. So that's kind of the trade-off there. I agree it's confusing because like as I look at this thing, I'm like, okay, then if 64 gigabytes is enough, then I need the 256 gigabyte iPad Air, which starts at $749. And then it's like, that's so close to iPad Pro territory. I should just get an iPad Pro. I should just like get that ProRes screen, you know? And like, it is an escalating thought line that kind of leads me to buying more expensive stuff. I will say for most people, seems like the iPad Air is best. For most people, the base iPad is fine. It is perfectly great. Great for kids. Put a nice case on that. It'll serve you real well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about this again also on the pre-show, but I feel like the iPad Air or the base iPad and the like smaller iPad Pro, they run the risk of kind of overlapping each other so much that one of them is just going to be discontinued. Like the iPad smaller Pro or the iPad Air, they're just so close. Right now, the differences are mostly that the iPad Air has M1. Does the iPad Pro have M1 yet?
Well, not yet. No, it does. iPad Pro has
it does? Okay.
Yeah. As of the fall. But no, the big difference is like, the better screen. The better screen, yes. Like some better accessories, I think like some better cameras and stuff too, right? So it's just the Air is the best balance overall of like, you know, performance and features and everything. But once they put ProRes, like once they put the nice ProMotion, once they put that in the iPad Air, like I will be there forever. That'll be my happy place. Yeah.
These look confusing times. Gorgeous. I'm not sure I'm getting one, but there you go. Speaking of gorgeous, I also want to quickly shout out that there were also two new iPhone 13s. A green an Alpine green.
Green? And green or green?
Green or green.
This is a color. I was like looking at minivans and stuff. Like Toyota is using a very similar color for the Sienna. It's called Woodland Green. So like green gadgets are kind of a thing right now. I don't know if I love this. It's fine. I think all the like metal sheens. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I prefer the green on the iPhone 12 series. Right. It's a little paler. But this one looks nice too. The pictures look boring. I think. I feel like, but in person, I think they might look better.
It's a green iPhone, folks. What do you want from us?
I also want to say before we move on too quickly or forget, the Apple also announced Friday Night Baseballs on TV Plus with MLB live sports coming to TV Plus for the very first time. So it's a significant deal for them.
Yeah, I don't really care about baseball, but I think the idea that you're getting live games right from within Apple TV Plus, like it is kind of a path forward, like maybe Major League Soccer games, maybe international audience, soccer games for the Ted Lasso audience.
Oh,
I think a lot of them will also be like, man, watching soccer is not as entertaining as watching Ted Lasso.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yes. Compared to
I used to play soccer. I used to watch soccer games. So, yes, it is.
Yeah, I agree. I did both. You need a lot of stamina for either one.
Which of the greens looks most like gum to you, Sherlyn?
Like gum?
Like gum.
Neither of them look like
winter
gum.
Green gum, double mint gum.
Oh, neither of them. They both look olivey. if that makes sense. They're more like army green, olive green. The 13 Pro has this sort of frosted finish that's similar to the rest of the colors in the 13 Pro lineup. That helps it add this sort of like sheen that might be nice. I don't know. I prefer the the iPhone 12 series is green. So, but it's definitely better than the Pixel 5's Sage.
Anything else you want to mention about the iPads or the iPhones? Because I want to get into the fun chip stuff.
And yeah, we should get into the highlight of the show. This was an Ultra show, wasn't it? All about the Ultra.
It's all about the Ultra. I feel like that should have been the tagline, just like really get us thinking about what it is. But the kind of like the most important thing I think Apple announced is the M1 Ultra chip. It's the company's fastest chip for computers ever. And essentially, it's kind of interesting. It is basically two M1 Max chips, which were the fastest ones that were in the MacBook Pro before. Two of those kind of just stuck together because they actually have this like interpolator. There's something, a die-to-die interconnect called UltraFusion that links the chips together. And that is pretty cool. Apple says that the bandwidth in that layer is up to 2.5 terabytes per second. So even though you've got two chips put together, there's not like going to be any slowdown in communication between them. And it is like everything about it just feels like what you get if you put two M1 Maxes together. It's a 20-core CPU with 16 high-performance and 4 high-efficiency cores. It has a 64-core GPU. It can support up to 128 gigabytes of unified memory. That's 128 gigabytes of RAM. That's not just insane for like you know, what you'd use in a computer, but also video editing apps or anything, or 3D rendering apps will be able to address that memory as video RAM, similar to like what is in a GPU on a PC. So it's like, that's insane. That is a wild amount of addressable memory. And it's going to get really expensive to get to that point once we're looking at the Mac Studio. But this chip is interesting because it's basically like Apple has kind of reached the current limit of what it can do with its 5-nanometer chip design. So where do you go from there? You stick two of them together. It reminds me of the days of like late 90s, early 2000 Windows desktops. And even like Macs did this. But, you know, dual CPUs, three CPUs, put them all together.
Sure.
That's how you get a little more power. And Apple's essentially recreating that. Do you have any thoughts about this chip, Sherlyn? It's just like so nerdy, but so powerful.
No, the fusion method sort of draws to mind for me the way like Intel had that like stack architecture thing, right? But it's not the same, obviously. Yeah. It's just for me, it's like, okay, I guess that's where we're going with the chips now. Well, so like, just find more ways to
AMD build has something called Infinity Fabric, and that's what connects like the GPU portions and the CPU portion of AMD's like Ryzen APUs. They're those like chips. It connects everything together. So this is becoming more and more important. It is fascinating to see Apple kind of go here so quickly right after they introduce these chips. And also every time we say UltraFusion, we just got to go UltraFusion like Dragon Ball, please.
Oh, no.
And you got to do the dance. We got to do the little dance.
Never.
Where's
saw
Dragon Ball. Yeah. Julio, there's your meme animation goal for this episode. Fusion DBZ dance with this chip. But yeah, it is, it's cool. They're saying it's up to, let me see here, up to 8 times faster graphics than the original M1 chip. It's going to be, because this thing is like aimed
looks like
at
it's
desktops.
8 times bigger too, by the way.
Eight times, I mean, it's two M1 Max chips put together. Yeah. So yeah. But this thing is aimed at desktop performance. So like it's probably not going to be in laptops at this point. So like power consumption, they're not aiming to be as power efficient as like they needed to with laptops, but it's still better than like competing x86 chips. Apple says it offers up to 90% better power per watt. So like the amount of like energy it takes to produce like high performance stuff. That's pretty cool. Good chip. Yummy chips.
It's love yummy. A good chip conversation. Yummy, exactly. Ranch chips are my favorite. No, I'm kidding. But it did seem like one of my favorite things from after the event closed was when we had our post-show recap, our live stream viewers were like, the next ship will be called the Ultra Superior Hydra or something. Like, I mean, I'm the one that threw that name out there, but there are just a lot of great ideas. What do we think? Is Apple done with the M1 series? Is the next time it reveals a ship, you know, the M2, or does it probably have one more M1 up its sleeve?
Okay. Probably. I feel like Ultra, I don't know how much more Ultra Plus, hyperbole. Plus Ultra, like yeah. You're going to go into like, was it My Hero Academia, basically, plus Ultra. That would be fun, actually, the My Hero Academia branded M1 chip. But no, this feels like the end of this, like before they give us an M2 or something like that. I think the main thing we are waiting to see, like, what is going to be the new MacBook Air? That is like the super popular computer that it's a year and a half old now. That was like the first M1 branded MacBook Air. And, you know, it was cool. That was a really cool MacBook Air, but it didn't really change much compared to like previous gen MacBook Air. So it's like we're waiting for a real redesign. We're waiting for maybe some new chips in there. It may not be an M2, but if it is an M2, we probably won't get it until the fall. So we'll see. We'll see. Mm-hmm.
There's still time from now until then. Yeah.
This chip. Where is this chip going?
Yeah.
This chip is going to be in the Mac Studio. There were rumors of the new Mac Mini, but it turns out it's basically this. It kind of has the same footprint, but it looks like a couple of Mac Minis put together. And this thing is kind of a powerhouse, too. Like, it starts at $2,000 with the M1 Max chip. So that's going to be a 10-core CPU, 24-core GPU. If you want the M1 Ultra chip, that is starting at $4,000 for that whole thing. I'm just, like, looking up the pricing here. And the price escalates pretty quickly, like, depending on what you add to it.
I saw a tweet that the maxed out version, I think it was Marquez that tweeted this, completely maxed out version of the Mac Studio was like $8,000. It was like $7,999.
I'm just looking at everything here, which is, that's a lot of money. But also, I think for people who are going to demand the kind of performance you could potentially get from a machine like this, that could be useful. But there are also the, it has a lot of ports at the back. It has ports up front. It has like all the stuff a desktop professional would probably need. But it's still a sealed box. It's not like user upgradable in any way. I hear you can open it just like a lot of other hardware, but you can't really get at much because the M1 is a SoC. It's not like the RAM is in there. Like everything is kind of in there. So you can't really do much. I'm sure people will be able to open it up and maybe get access to the SSDs or something eventually. But really, this is supposed to be a sealed box. And I think a lot of people are like, they're still waiting for the new Mac Pros, which Apple has been talking about for years now. They even hinted at it at the event here this week. And they're like, they're not ready to talk about it yet, but it's coming soon. My bet is probably WWDC, right? For when we hear more about that.
That's what a lot of people said. I'm not sure. I think I think they could. But I think there's every chance that Apple does a dedicated event for it.
I just feel like the way to get developers excited, like the people who are always crying for like better, faster, you know, more geeky Apple hardware is that crowd. So and it's also that would probably be a couple months away. So it gives Apple enough buffer time between these devices and something else.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, I don't know much about Apple's like launch schedule. They tend to be not super predictable. They just have like several events a year, and I just grit my teeth for
Dub is usually in the middle of the year at some point, because usually it was like right after, wasn't it right after Computex?
Computex,
typically, yeah. Beyond that, so the Mac Studio looks good. We will be using, we will be looking into these things eventually to see like how they perform. So here's a good thing to put. If you saw the Mac Studio, you knew you immediately needed it. What are you going to use it for? Because I feel like that's the thing. It is kind of hard. It's getting harder to tell, like, what device do I need? Do I need a Mac Mini? Do I need a MacBook Air? Should I just get the 16-inch MacBook Pro? I think the differentiating points between those things are getting harder and harder to tell. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Let us know what you think about all this new hardware. One other thing Apple announced is the new Mac Studio display, or the new 5K Studio display. It's a 27-inch 5K screen. It costs $15.99. It has an A13 processor in it. Did not expect that. But it's basically a new Mac monitor. It has a built-in 12 megapixel ultra-wide camera, which is kind of what the chip is dealing with. It's dealing with center stage and a bunch of audio stuff. It's fine. It's cool. It seems like a really nice Mac monitor. What do you think, Sherlyn?
Well, the funny thing that came out overnight as news was that, like, this is not just a Mac monitor. Apparently, it can also work with Windows machines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Although we don't know, like, how center stage and everything will be compatible.
Oh, yeah. No, none of those special camera features are going to work. It's just the cameras and speakers will work as normal, but you won't get the, like, Apple-style features like
center stage. I don't feel like that's not news. You expect it. Even old Mac monitors worked with Windows machines.
Right. You would think it's fine. Exactly an output. Like, just read it as a normal output. But the other thing that I saw a lot of people talk about was how 27 inch is just kind of a bad size. Like, people were hoping for a bigger 32
bigger,
inch screen, maybe.
Bigger would be nice. I would love to see Apple, like, get into, like, ultra-wide territory, which is my, like, sweet spot for monitors right now. Right in front of me right now, folks. I'll be writing about this later. I have that new, the Alienware 34-inch QD OLED gaming monitor. So it's, like, it's beautiful. It's fantastic. It also costs less than this thing. Than this Apple display. And that is kind of wild to me. The Apple display also only has a tilting stand.
Right,
if you want the ability to just pull the monitor up and down a bit, a little bit of height adjustability, that's an extra $400. And when I heard that, like, just a part of me just, like, started screaming, because I don't know why you're doing this, Apple. You don't need to make a $1,600 monitor, a $2,000 monitor just for a stand, just for height adjustability. Just wild to me.
And then also you can flip the screen vertical, which, like, cool.
With
the
height
adjustability. I can see the use cases.
Yeah,
with the specific stand that adds that. But, I mean, not to, like, you know, say that, like, using it in vertical format is not a huge bonus for some people. Some people prefer it that way. But just adding that $400 premium for that and the height adjustability,
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Like, almost every Dell monitor I see, like, all the way down to, like, their super cheap $200, $300 monitors have built-in height adjustability. A lot of them have the ability to tilt too. Like, that's not a new feature, in a monitor stand, you know? So, and some people like that because, like, you would have maybe two monitors. You could have two dual displays in the middle, maybe a portrait on the side for, like, long feeds, spreadsheets, social media, stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of ways to do it. I currently have, like, I have my own ultra wide monitor. I'm like, I could get a portrait screen on the side just to keep track of Slack and everything. I don't know. There's a lot of uses for that. It's just infuriating. And your choices now, like, if you want a good Mac display, is like this 27 inch screen or the Pro Display XDR, which is $5,000.
Oh my gosh.
And the better stand for that is was $1,000. Remember, now it's cheaper.
All right, jeez. I just think that if you're setting up a workspace for creative people, for designers, people who use a lot of, you know, creative tools like a monitor like that or a lot of power, just be ready to shell out a lot of money. Right? It sounds like the $4,000 Mac Studio plus a studio display, that package is gonna set you back what? Like, so many thousands of dollars, I can't even count that high.
Like, here's the thing. Like, I can justify for some people, like, spending $4,000 in the Mac Studio. Like, if it makes your workflow better and faster, like, that leads to more money for you. That is a worthwhile investment. Spending this amount of money on a Mac monitor, which has far limited features compared to, like, what we're seeing from Dell's and stuff and other companies, really any other company making monitors these days, it is ridiculous. And let me remind you all, the Pro Display XDR starts at $5,000. It has no stand. It has no stand at all. If you want to add a stand, that is another $1,000. They're assuming you have, like, mounting monitor arms
like a
and
wall
stuff,
bracket, yeah.
Which is fine, but I'm just freaking out over here in the way Apple designs these things and thinks of pricing these things. If you want the nano texture glass, the slightly better anti-reflective glass, that is $18.99 for the Apple Studio display.
That makes the total $18.99. Okay.
That is $18.99. Plus, if you want the tilt and height adjustable stand, that raises the total price to $2,300. So for a 27-inch monitor, that's ridiculous to me. Sometimes Apple does things where, like, oh man, this will make a lot of people's lives easier. This is really, like, reshaping the consumer landscape. And sometimes Apple does shit that's like, I don't, how do you expect anybody to swallow this? But somehow it happens every single time. I mean, don't you,
didn't they make, how much was that microfiber cloth that they sold last time? Was it like $50?
Yeah. I mean, it's good microfiber.
I guess, could make my skin just glow, I guess. I don't know. One of our live chat viewers, Mark Dell, says, can't we buy wheels for the Mac Studio? And this reminds me of that, didn't they have like some kind of tower that had its own like
that was the wheels for the last Mac Pro were also super expensive. And they got right. cheaper. You probably don't need wheels for the Mac Studio because it's a cute little boy. Yeah. It's a chunky Mac Mini, as we would like to say.
honky. It's onky, actually. It's just an onky Mac Mini. Yeah,
but I'm seeing a note here saying the microfiber cloth is actually $20. I think it was more expensive before that, but still, even $20. Think of like what you can the multi packs of microfiber you can buy for far, far less. Anyway, folks, let us know. What do you think of the Mac? This Apple Studio display. Is it disappointing? Would you just rather pair like a Dell monitor, which Dell makes really good monitors? I think people don't like talk about this enough, but their screens are generally good. They have good warranties. I like their hardware a lot. So would you rather have something like that with your Mac Studio? Let us know. podcast@engadget.com. Let's move on to some other news, and it's a little Google heavy. So you know what that means. We gotta call in the Google heavyweight Trillin. Trillin Low. What is going on with Google?
I feel like I'm going to come up with my own intro music. Yeah, I like my own jingle. Time for Google with Trillin. Ding, ding. Anyway.
Wow.
Yes, there has been a bunch of Google news, starting with three pieces of news announced on Monday. Android 12L that we've talked about before, the sort of update to Android 12 that will make it friendlier for larger screens. It's coming out of beta, and Google's officially said that it will be heading to foldables and tablets later this year. That is still a very vague window, but they've actually named companies that are working to implement this. So they've said Samsung, Lenovo, and Microsoft devices will be pushing this update later this year, which means, I mean, we know Samsung's got the foldables and the tablets, Lenovo with the P12 Pro being one of the earliest devices you can get 12L on already as a beta. But with Microsoft, that means the Duo, right? Like, we're expecting 12L to come to Duo. What will that look like? I feel like that's very intriguing. But we also kind of already know what that will look like because, once again, as a reminder, Sam Rutherford, our senior editor or senior writer, did a hands-on with the 12L beta. So you can check that out to see what are some of the new features coming. Hopefully that makes a difference. For Samsung devices, it probably doesn't make a huge difference because Samsung's already integrated a lot of like big screen friendly features into its devices through One UI. But perhaps for like the more generic Android or the cleaner versions of Android on tablets, this might actually make tablets more useful. Who knows?
Literally anything is better. Like just do something, do something more. It'll make for Android tablets better. Yeah.
I'll just shout out one example that seems like a no-brainer. You know how when you're like using your tablet, you pull down the notification shade and it's just one giant window that spans the entire width of your tablet, especially when you hold it landscape? Now with Android 12L, it will detect when the screen width is above a certain DPI, I believe it was 600-ish DPI, and then bring up a two-column notification shade. Wow, like, whoa, okay. What a great way to use space. So there you go. And also a new taskbar and that sort of thing. But yeah, that's coming later this year. I guess it's just something to look out for. We won't know really how much this will impact or make Android tablets any better than iPads, right? Like we were saying, iPadOS.
I don't know. It's too late. It's too late to say like better in any way. But if you can deliver, if you could give me like the features of the iPad Air or even the iPad Pro, like give me a $400 10-inch tablet with like fast motion, a really nice screen, like then you have my interest, you know, then I'll be thinking about it. And like a good keyboard accessory, like give me a great $300 to $400 device that kind of does all this stuff, and then I'll be thinking about it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know so much about like a great keyboard accessory not being existing yet, but I will say that I think there has been good Android tablet hardware for a while now.
Sure.
We've got Samsung making it, but it's not
the Android. It's really all the Galaxy Tab S. Yeah, yeah.
Right. But and Samsung's one of those companies that doesn't really need that huge boost from Android 12L, like we said. But will it make it closer to iPad territory? Maybe. I'm not sure.
I remember, we'll see. Was it the first Galaxy Tab S or was it the S2? But they had this like launch event in freaking Madison Square Garden. Like I walked into like one of the smaller portions of Madison Square Garden and like Samsung just had a bunch of OLED tablets lit up. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. That is something iPads aren't doing. And then they were really the only ones innovating. I feel like Google has been asleep at the wheel at tablets for so long. So, hey, this is something.
Speaking of like things that Google is good at, I'm not sure this is necessarily something good at. Chrome, right? Chrome's been around forever. I love Chrome as a browser. But what Google announced this week, too, is that the next version of Chrome 99, is going to be a lot faster on Macs and on Android devices. On Macs specifically, I think the claim is that Chrome on Macs will outperform Safari, which I guess, if you want to keep people using your browser on other platforms, speed is one of the things to be concerned about and to upgrade. So if y'all are speed demons when you're browsing your web, I'm more interested in like the just Chrome using less RAM, I guess, or just,
I mean, yeah, I feel like the curse of being the dominant browser is that you inevitably become terrible, right? You become a memory hog. So many things will go wrong. And the curse of like that happened to Firefox, you know, that happened to poor Firefox. I think from the beginning, that was what was going on with Internet Explorer. So it kind of happens over and over again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People like lighter browsers run faster. Who knew? But anyhow, that's one more piece of info for everyone that uses Chrome browsers. There are some interesting updates from Google this week as well about some features that debuted on the Galaxy S22 phones that were at the time supposed to be exclusive to the Galaxy S22, and it seems like they're no longer. For example, on Monday, there was news about a new Pixel feature drop. That's what Google calls them. And it brings improved captioning, translating, and live sharing on Duo, the, you know, Google's video call app that basically nobody uses except when forced to. Duo now gets the same live sharing features that the S22 series had, which is sort of similar to Apple's SharePlay, but it's not the same. It's not as deeply integrated. It's basically a screen sharing feature, live sharing on Duo. So would this convince some of you to use Duo to talk to your family and friends over Android? Let me know. I mean, I might start forcing my parents to use it.
Duo is such an annoying service. Like, first of all, Google has to like pick one. Pick one thing. Are you going to use Hangouts? Are you going to use Duo? Are you going to use Google Chat? I guess Google Chat became Hangout, but it's very confusing.
I don't know what's going on.
Very
there
hard
now, yeah.
to use.
I know. Hey, but one thing that did stick around is Google's Messages. They're somehow, I mean, not giving up on Android Messages, the app. Failing to like make RCS really a real thing, whatever, but continuing in the theme of bringing things that were first exclusive to the S22 series to the rest of Android, we've got YouTube previews in Messages. Great. Hey, now all Android phones will get it instead of just the S22s. There's also a bunch of other, the emoji reaction thing that we've been hearing about for a while now it's finally officially going to roll out. You also get a thing called organized inbox where you can, you know, just put the messages that are more important to you in the priority folder, that sort of thing, and just like a whole ton more updates coming to Android. You can read the articles on Engadget.com. I will shout out that Live Translate now works offline, and Google pitched that as an accessibility feature, which does, you know, it does make sense if you want to see captions for videos or things that are playing on your phone, I believe.
Do you want to mention, I see you also have some other Android updates around parking. Is that important enough to mention? Or
Android Auto. No, you can pay to park with your voice. Cheers.
That's pretty cool because one thing I have to deal with now is occasional city parking. And it's like, you got to learn the new systems. Like, which app are you? Are you just like, there aren't really coin meters anymore. So you either have to look for like the little booth and get a ticket, or you use like some variety of a mobile app, and every, like every county has a different app, and it's really annoying. So, hey, if I could just be like, okay, just pay for the parking, make my life easier. That's nice. I'd be down with that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So as someone who doesn't park, doesn't even have a car to park.
Can't drive.
This definitely, yeah.
It's well, just like really going down the checklist here. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why that definitely not something that I personally
can you drive, quote unquote, like you.
I can, quote unquote, drive. Stick is what I learned. I learned manual transmission. Didn't do the test. did not manage to not kill anyone. Okay. Which honestly,
so in a zombie really apocalypse where you were forced to drive, you could probably figure it out at some point.
I can go forward. The main thing is I never learned how to go backwards.
That's kind of important.
I know.
It's pretty important. I know. Like as the hordes amass in front of you, and yeah.
Yeah, I know. One time I drove a golf cart into a ditch because I was going backwards.
That checks out. Let's move on to some other news. And actually, something that dropped as we were recording this, people were sending us links. Thank you, Mark Dell, in the chat room. Magic Leap announced the Magic Leap 2 AR glasses, which are, they look like a redesigned set. I'm looking at the hands-on coverage from Scott Stein over at CNET. Love his work around AR, VR stuff. These look like better, more optimized glasses. And they also have this cool thing where they can like darken the outer world to make the holograms look a little better too. It's really interesting that they're still pursuing this. I know these are more like business focused glasses, as are HoloLens right now. And I think that's where a bunch of this business is going. But it did seem a couple of years ago like Magic Leap was just like dead, right? Like they lost the original CEO, the one who helped like that company raise $2 billion, like a bunch of money. And then like it was never really a consumer product. And even like the original Magic Leap glasses were kind of disappointing. Did you ever try those out, Sherlyn?
I did. I found them like the visual was just a little too transparent. I just couldn't really see.
Right.
Like it didn't feel real and immersive. It just felt like a demo product.
I think that's what this kind of fixes by like, it's like wearing sunglasses inside, it looks like. So it makes the holograms look a little better. There is a newly redesigned controller. I'm seeing like an AMD powered like hip pocket computer. It's an AMD processor. The last one just had a Snapdragon XR2. So this is a huge leap in performance.
Right.
So, you know, that's really interesting. And yeah, hopefully we'll get to try this out soon. Unfortunately, like I'm missing out on some of these like really cool demos because I'm no longer like near New York. I am trying to make trips in when I can. Are you intrigued by this, Sherlyn? Like, would you want to try these out if you could?
I mean, I recently tried out for the first time TCL's Next Air.
Right.
Their wearable, yeah, it used to be called Project Archer. They've changed the name so many times on me, I don't really know now. But no, that one actually felt very light and comfortable to wear. And based on the pictures I'm seeing on Scott Stein over at CNET's hands-on, they look kind of similar, right? The Magic Leap 2 looks also lightweight and comfortable. And he seems to find them really greatly improved. So I'm intrigued. I mean, that's where we're headed. I think the glasses format, rather than like a strap-on headset, is something that I find more approachable, something that I prefer. So yeah, no, definitely keen to test this out.
And probably like these are the rumors we've heard Apple working on at some point, like some sort of AR glasses product. So like something is happening in the space. It is clearly not ready yet. I'm really excited by a lot of the VR stuff I've seen and some of the AR stuff. Like I've tried out HoloLens 2 in a couple demos. Like one time, it was like last year or a year and a half ago, like at the beginning of the pandemic, right after I moved here, Microsoft shipped HoloLens 2 to show off like their Meta virtual chat system. Like it was really wild to be able to just put on glasses and then like see people around me in my physical space. It wasn't just like blocking out my field of view like the Quest VR does. So there's a lot of potential here, a lot of potential for like dystopian realities too that we're going to be moving right into. So who knows, but I'm really intrigued by this. I'm also really beginning to like appreciate the time in my life and during the day where I could just like close my eyes and not have screens and stuff in front of me. So,
I know.
You know,
this is probably part of why I don't enjoy, like, you know, I don't want to strap a screen to my face. I'm good. I need a lot of time away from screens.
You need time away. Yeah.
I will shout out that, like, I actually thought for a while that the glasses format might be just a little more of an inclusive design compared to the strap-on head goggles setup, because for people with big hair or that sort of thing, you know, a lot of VR headsets are notorious for not being very accommodating of people with different hair types. But then the glasses format needs to also be conscious of accommodating people with vision issues, with, like, who need to fit their glasses in or don't wear contacts, or get those with lenses that, you know, prescription
That's
lenses
me.
And that sort of stuff.
It's a me. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. That is like my main, especially when it comes to like AR and VR stuff. That's where I'm like, yeah, this is an accessibility feature that affects everybody, right? Actually, just we talked about the Facebook Bluetooth glasses, the Wayfarer, those things. You can get those with prescription lenses.
Yeah, the Ray-Ban stories.
You could get those with prescription lenses. I feel like that stuff needs to be easier and more accessible for people to like buy at some point too. But it does make a big difference too. Yeah. I want a VR headset with my full prescription. Like, that'll be, then I don't have to wear glasses. And it's like,
oh,
it'll be a little more.
And whenever you want, you turn it on.
For sure.
But yeah, I mean, that's, I feel like that's coming, but in the future. And we're not there yet.
I hope so. I'm hoping, honestly, like, I'm hoping eventually, like, these lenses will be able to, like, do the work to dial in the prescription. Like, look at my eyes. Do that work. Like, we are going to have that tech eventually. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
There you go.
Wow.
Just, we're talking about eye tracking and, you know, give me like, look at my vision, fix my vision, give me a screen with better vision. That'll be kind of cool. Let's move on. Other news. LimeWire is back in NFT form.
I mean, it's not an NFT. It's now an NFT marketplace.
It's an NFT marketplace, but still the form of an NFT, like, it's
vendor,
an NFT for
trader.
Newbies marketplace, basically. Do you have, I don't really have any feelings about, like, what this could be, but do you have any affinity to LimeWire or those, like, old-style file sharing services?
It's so sad to me because I love LimeWire. LimeWire was, like, one of my gateways to the world, right? And then now it's taking the form of facilitating something I hate. I really do not enjoy NFTs. And, like, come on. I love you, LimeWire, because, like I said, it's so much of my teenage years were spent knowing what it's about. I won't admit to whether or not I used LimeWire.
So what were you, and I don't know, maybe statutes of limitations have passed, but we were all young and occasionally like dabbled in things. And what were you
poor
dabbling
and broke.
With LimeWire? Yeah, exactly.
Right. Certainly not for poor and broke people anymore, right? I don't think of people who trade in NFTs as
not NFTs,
way.
But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But back in the day, yes, LimeWire was a nice place to, you know, be a file exchange program and get things that I wouldn't otherwise be able to find in Singapore. It's more about, like, access, right, than it is about trying to break the law for me. Because in Singapore, there's just so much censorship. There's so many limits mm-hmm. on what you can watch.
Oh, man. Were they really harsh about file sharing, too? Because it seemed like Singapore went hardcore on many, many laws. Yeah.
God, I got away with it. A lot
you
of
got
things.
Like, I think I once got like a letter from an ISP. It was like, we see you BitTorrenting Batman
yes.
Begins. Don't do that. You can't do anything else. Whereas I think some other countries could be like, you're going to go to jail for a very long
right.
time if we see this again.
I never got that from Singapore, but I did like one of my earlier years in New York. Accidentally
in college?
Leave mm-hmm. I can't remember when, but I suddenly left like MuTorrent running in the background for no reason. I never had it open before that. And then I got an email, not an email, a letter delivered. It was like, you've been using this, stop seeding this torrent. I was like, wow. I was like, oh, I had accidentally left something on
yeah.
there that was seeding to other people.
Kids these days. Wouldn't know. It was a weird thing where the RIAA and the MPAA were basically out there scanning internet traffic and was like sending letters to through ISPs, but also through schools. I knew people at my college, like if you were downloading something, then the college would be like, hey, just stop. We can't do anything about this, but just stop. For me, the ones I really miss are like Audio Galaxy. I do miss the like sort of like it was like peer-to-peer sharing music stuff too. I would like get some really cool stuff there. I mean, college was just like a wonderland of like a closed network where everybody was like, here are all my anime soundtracks. Just go in. Windows file sharing. Just drag them over to your computer. That was fun. I used to be
I remember Yeah, I remember the little like race and the obstacles too, right? Because like people would just like LimeWire was, I think, one of the earlier ones. Then they got shut down or restrictions were imposed, and then people all just jumped ship to Kazaa and then BitTorrent and then MuTorrent, and then I don't really know where we are now. And then I remember when they would keep trying to shut down the Pirate Bay in the past, and Pirate Bay would just move somewhere else. I was like, all right, Pirate Bay's gone for you.
For the most part.
It's now gone, yeah.
It is, well, it's like a weird thing now. But yeah, file sharing was a weird, it was a wild time back in the day. Let me put it that way. So I don't know. LimeWire's back. I don't know if I will ever use this as a thing. And oh, I got a little legal note here. Under United States federal law, the statute of limitations on copyright infringements, it's only 3 years, according to a website called felonies.org. LOL. Thank you, Ben.
Felonies.org. That's my go-to source for information.
I mean, that is for people like, did I just commit a felony? You go to felony.org. That's how you know.
Sounds about right. But yeah, no, nostalgia aside, it seems like, well, I'm just happy to see the logo, happy to see the brand around. Not sure I will partake anymore. Speaking of things that I'm not sure I will partake in, Carl Pei. Hey, remember Carl Pei, the former co-founder of OnePlus or former director of OnePlus? And, you know, they like Carl left and did his own company called Nothing. Last year, Nothing launched some new headphones, earbuds. Uh-huh. This year, people are stoked to like see if the company is going to launch a phone, I guess. And we're hearing, or we got news this week, that Nothing plans to reveal its 2022 roadmap in an event on March 23rd. Nobody's really sure what it's going to announce, but the wireless earbuds that it announced last year or that launched last year had this like transparent case design that let you see the internals of the device.
Cool. Yeah, and yeah.
I know that our producer Ben is stoked if they bring this sort of
style to a smartphone. We miss clear gadgets. Yeah. I mean, I remember there was a heyday of that. Like, I think one of the Game Boys back in the day, like, there was a Game Boy Advance with like a clear case. There was, of course, the original IMAX. So it's like that was a thing for a while. Yes. Most recently, go ahead.
For me, it was the Nokia phones that like you could swap out the case, and I would always swap out for a transparent case. Always
looks cool. I like seeing my tech. And if we're gonna go like full on cyberpunk, like I need some visible tech. I need to see some hardware, open wires and whatnot. Most recently, I think there was a Forza Horizon 5 custom, like a special controller for the Xbox Series X and S that is like slightly transparent. Looks really cool. What if Carl Pei just like opens a box and it's empty? It's just like.
Nothing. I unveil nothing.
Let's move on to what we're working on. I am still in the middle of interviewing the Intel NUC 12 Extreme, which has become a long, long process. Like a long, long process. Bloody fingers and whatnot, like getting into this case and everything. It is funny that this thing came right before Apple announced the Mac Studio, because like now it seems like mini desktops are getting like more and more interesting. So
again? There's that.
Again, look out. Yeah. Again, I mean, you could do so much more with small spaces now, too. So, like, there is a bit of a battle going on there. That is cool. I wrote up the Kia Sorento, the 2022 Sorento plug-in hybrid that I tested a couple of months ago. I did a quick write-up for that at Engadget. Check it out. I think it's a really cool, like, family car. I'm really interested in plug-in hybrids, especially looking at, like, where gas prices are now. The last time I filled up my car, that was actually my old car, the RAV4 hybrid, gas was like $3.25, $3.20. I just went and filled up the Pacifica minivan. It is $4.25 down here.
I know. Per gallon. The prices are out of hand.
It's crazy. There's a lot of stuff happening, obviously. So there's a lot of things affecting that. But now is the time where it's like, if you had a little bit of EV, if you had like 30 miles of EV that you just charge overnight and you could get that. I've owned this minivan for about like 2.5 months. And this is the first time I'm putting in any gas, you know? And for the first month, I was all EV. Like, all the trips I were doing pretty much covered the EV range. So it's like, I never need to go beyond that. There is a recall happening now. God damn it. So I'm not charging my car. So now I'm using gas and I'm less happy. But anyway, the Sorento plug-in hybrid, it's really interesting. I think my big takeaway is that I really wish it was a Telluride, because a Telluride is like, every time I see one of those on the road, I'm like, that is a beautiful car. Does not have great fuel efficiency, but it's big enough for like families. It's big enough for two kids. That's been the obsession that I've been like looking for a while. So a Telluride with better gas mileage and certainly with some EV would be like the perfect family SUV, I think. So anyway, hope we see that eventually. Working on a bunch of other stuff, but you'll hear more about that in the next few weeks. Sherlyn, what's up with you?
Yeah, no, my secrets and my deadlines keep getting moved on me. Also, a lot of the stuff that I publish recently and in the near future are things that like get dropped on me last minute. So not a lot I can tell you about, but I'm always working, as everyone knows. But I want to take this opportunity to draw your attention then to the people whose work I can talk about. Like, for example, our senior editor, Daniel Cooper, wrote an explainer about how Telegram found itself at the heart of the Ukrainian conflict. I mean, who knew? But also, Telegram is a good messaging app. I love it. It's great. Also,
fully as secure as people think, right? Like, go read that article so you know exactly what Telegram offers. Yeah,
part of the reason I don't like to tell people what messaging apps I use most of the time is because I don't want to encourage hacking of it, because I always think the world is out to get me. But this is not my personal therapy session. Moving on, Andrew Tarantola also wrote a story on Engadget called "Cities Turn to Tech to Keep Sewers Free of Fatbergs." Do you know what a fatberg is, Devendra?
The big lumps of like fat that are floating around the oceans, yeah? In garbage, yeah.
It's globs of grease and wet naps, yeah. And they block pipes. So, you know, there's
grease
a story
is bad, folks. Wipe up your grease. Wipe up your grease. I had to teach my wife this too. Like, I make bacon for myself and my daughter. My wife doesn't eat it, but bacon grease, you got to wait for that stuff to solidify. You got to like be really careful. Don't just dump that down your drain. But anyway, fatbergs. That's cool.
Yes. A story on fatbergs is just fun to say and fun to tell y'all about. There's also a piece by James True, our editor at large. It is a hands-on with the Ergo 6, which is basically like a tiny, invisible, self-adjusting hearing aid. James's early take on it is that they don't scrimp on the features, which is nice. And James is one of our like hearing aid testers on the team, himself needing one. So, I mean, this is, I love his coverage of this stuff. James's writing is also just such a breeze.
It's super
to read,
cool. So, and James like spent a lot of his life listening to very loud music. And yes. A warning, folks, to please, if you're going to concerts, if you're right in front of the speakers, wear some buds, wear some protection, because you don't get that back. You lose it forever. Like, if you surround yourself with loud things. There's also a story about Audi's RS e-tron. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Robbie. There's a fun video too.
Roberta Baldwin, contributor to Engadget, who covers cars and really, really cool stuff. He drove the RS e-tron GT. So Audi's like really cool EVs on ice. So go check out that video. It looks like he had a lot of fun.
Yeah, and there's plenty more around Engadget that you can check out, but these are just something we wanted to highlight this week.
Let's move on to our pop culture picks. What do you got for me this week, Sherlyn? You have a secret.
Man, So this is one of those weeks where like I didn't have anything to tell y'all to watch, but I dug into my archives. I have a list of like recommendations I keep handy whenever I need one, when my life's been so bad that I haven't been watching anything. So this week it's an older horror movie called The Deep House. Have you heard of this one, Dev?
No, I've not heard of it.
Man, the premise alone is so interesting. It's basically this couple.
It's a house underwater.
What? Yeah, it's a house. Yeah, fully underwater. They're uh-huh. Like they take their scuba gear, or I'm not sure exactly the right type of gear.
This can't be haunted. Right, let's go to the underwater house.
Totally not. Yeah, exactly. And then they go in. And it's creepy. So it's a haunted house story, but with a interesting take. And the technology for me in terms of how they film this is also cool. Like the premise is that these two are like adventurers with a YouTube channel. So of course they've got what's coming to them. No, but they have this little drone, like underwater drone for their GoPro, and they send their GoPro drone around ahead of them into these dark, creepy spaces, and things start becoming weird and scary. Gosh, it wasn't a, I have like no fear whatsoever for horror movies anymore. I just thought it was interesting. I actually laughed at some parts just because that's just me now when I watch horror movies. But it is, I thought it was fascinating. I thought the suspense was nice. Some scenes were very annoying because they were just like almost epileptic causing, you know, like epileptic fit inducing scenes. But besides that, this was an intriguing story.
That's fun. So speaking of horror movies, did you see the trailer for Uma, the Sandra Oh movie?
No, not yet.
I will recommend
Uma,
that to you.
Like Korean for mother?
Mm-hmm. It is a horror movie about her dealing with like the trauma of her mother and fearing of becoming her mother, and she's haunted by her mother. It looks scary. It looks like that sort of like...
I really want to watch that.
It looks really cool. So there's a good trailer for that out there. Go check that out. I've been watching a couple of shows. I've been watching Our Flag Means Death on HBO. This is another show from Taika Waititi. It has that like New Zealand sensibility of humor. It stars Rhys Darby as like a nice guy pirate. The photo we're looking at right now is Taika Waititi as Blackbeard. So we haven't seen him yet in the show, but he looks like he's going to have a lot of fun. It's about a nice guy, rich guy, basically pretending to be a pirate. He treats his crew well. He pays them a salary. He cares about their social, emotional well-being. He's like a nice guy. But when it comes to like the actual work of pirating, he's having trouble being a murderer and a pillager and things like that. So is that inherent comedy of like a rich guy pretending to be a pirate? Rhys Darby is really funny. The entire cast is really good. There's several Game of Thrones people in here, including Joel Fry. And the guy who played Hodor, Kristen Narn is in here too. So they're in it together as like a pirate crew. I think that alone makes it fun. It's very sweet. It is really funny. And it has that like vibe of Taika Waititi comedy. So if you like that stuff, and I really do, like What We Do in the Shadows, check this out. I've also been reviewing, I've watched all of Upload season 2 that we've gotten so far. And by the way, we've got an interview with the creator of Upload, Greg Daniels, a former writer on The Simpsons, creator of King of the Hill, and, you know, many, many great TV shows. Both of us really liked Upload season 1. That is on Amazon Prime. I think this season isn't as strong. It's sort of like it is building on the world they introduced, which is, you know, a world where when you die, you could upload your consciousness to a VR universe. And now that we're all talking about the metaverse, it's all like a little more like trenchant. It seems like something people would be more into or paying money to. You don't have to die to go there. You could just upload into a VR space and like hang out with your relatives who are dead in real life. This season introduces like more concepts like the Luddites, the people who are very anti-tech because it seems like tech has sort of like destroyed this world. I think the show needs a bigger budget or something. Like, I think the limits of how cheap it looks sometimes is really getting there. And there was one scene where they were like, we're in Central Park, guys. We're just hanging out in Central Park. And it's like a tiny patch of grass in front of a strip mall. I'm like, guys, what are you doing? I know Vancouver is tough, but Vancouver has green space. You could do something. It just looks a little cheap, and I think the writing isn't as good this season. But, you know, check out my chat with Greg Daniels because he was really excited about exploring this. I think it's worth watching. I think certainly the first season is worth a watch. Yes. So yes. I would say check
that
out. I
love the world they built, too, like you said. Yeah. So that alone, I think, is worth exploring. Kind of the future, slightly dystopian almost, but something that could be an eventuality for us, almost.
We've got a bunch of coverage around Upload season 1. I probably won't be writing anything about season 2. It's just super busy right now. But you could go check out our old coverage. Sherlyn, you also did the Comic-Con or the South By?
Yeah, moderated the Comic-Con panel for Upload season 1.
You
that
can
was fun.
Find
that
somewhere. Yeah, that's uploaded somewhere. I'm sure you could find that online.
On Amazon's Prime Video site, actually.
So you can see Sherlyn talking to Robbie Amell and not trying to melt into a puddle. Yeah.
Oh, man. And also Greg Daniels. He was great to talk to. Yeah.
Good cast. I have a crush on everybody in that cast. It's just like a really, really fun show. I've also caught up entirely on Euphoria season 2, and I'm just throwing that out there because, goddamn, this show is This is wild. It's really wild to see the internet like catch up to the show, because I felt like I was watching Euphoria season one kind of in a vacuum, like me and a bunch of other like film nerds were like, this show is really, really interesting. It's shot really well. It's one of the most dynamic like pieces of filmmaking on television. And season two, not as good, a little bit of like the upload problem, but also it turns out the entire internet decided to watch the show all at once. So like when things got bad, the internet was like on fire. Everybody wanted to like just burn the show to the ground, which made me think about like the power of fandom and everything. I watched it after a lot of those reactions, like in my own space and at my own time. I was like, yeah, there are certain bits that aren't as good, but it is still a really compelling show. It focuses on, you know, kids in this town, focuses on basically Zendaya's character, who's a recovering drug addict, her experiences with that, but also all the people in her lives. Like, it is very much a teen soap opera of kids struggling to deal with their identity, or, you know, how they relate to their friends, how do you deal with if your best friend is a drug addict, and how do you help
them,
with that in general, and how do you help them? Yeah, there's a lot going on, but it's also like it does kind of lean into like the more maximalist stylings of the director, the creator, Sam Levinson. So it is both like a really compelling teen drama, but also a hardcore drug show that can get really violent at times too, like a gangster show. It is wild. I think the filmmaking is still really good, but clearly season two has had some issues. I'm just throwing this out there because I think Euphoria season one is one of the best seasons of TV I've seen in a very long time. It's really creative. If you're a parent, it'll probably freak you the hell out, because it's sort of like, oh man, kids going to parties every night, just like doing it's kids having a lot of sexy times in high school, like just hardcore. It is scary for parents, but I think really compelling television. So I'm going to throw that out there. Sherlyn, I think you'd enjoy it quite a bit too. And that's it for me. Stick around for our interview with Greg Daniels, the creator of Upload, right after the show.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, and talking about movies and TV and reviewing shows like Euphoria on the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you have any ideas for fun places to find a haunted house, you can send them to me on Twitter. I'm at Sherlyn Lowe. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts.
Hey, everyone. Here's our interview with Greg Daniels about Upload Season 2, his latest series over at Amazon Prime Video. You'd most likely know him for working on The Simpsons or creating King of the Hill or the US version of The Office. This show, as we've talked about before on the podcast, is a more mature thing. It's about people who are uploading their minds into virtual worlds, which is also a thing people are doing after they die. It's a really cool, like, near future sci-fi universe. It's really funny, and both Sherlyn and I really enjoyed season one. Season two adds a lot more elements to the story and, you know, makes the world a lot more complex too. And here's what Greg Daniels had to say about it. Greg Daniels, thank you so much for joining us in the Engadget podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You know, I loved Upload Season 1. I thought it was a fantastic introduction to a dystopia that felt very real, like something we're heading towards, maybe without, you know, the consciousness uploading, but the actual world setting around it felt very realistic. What were you hoping to accomplish with Season 2?
We were extending the romantic storyline between Nathan and Maura, and getting more opportunities to kind of play with the world that we've created. And there's a, you know, the sort of episodes in the middle of the season, like the beginning and the ends are often very arcy with mystery beats. But there's a lot of opportunity for just plain comedy, episodic fun in the middles of the season. So, you know, we had so much fun with, say, the characters of Luke and Alicia last year. There's more out of them, and more kind of concepts about what could possibly be a new technology being introduced, and you kind of see the way that the people introducing it hope to make money off of it. And it's, you know, whether you want them to succeed or not is very questionable, but you know, there's a lot of comedy in that, I think, in the notion of when these new tech products come out and you're only told the good parts of them.
Oh, yeah. We know that very well over at Engadget. So, yeah. I'm also wondering, like, you know, what was your experience just producing season two? Because a lot of content, a lot of like TV shows I'm seeing now, like they've been delayed because of the pandemic. You know, the writing team has had over a year longer than usual to like work on it. Did the pandemic influence the show? Did having more time work on it change anything? And, you know, like we're relying more on technology now than ever, right? I feel like the themes of upload seem more like relevant now that everybody's Zooming and working. A lot of people are working from home. Yeah. How did the pandemic affect season two overall?
Well, you're completely right. I mean, the theme of the show being a person who is entirely existing in a virtual environment, trying to have a romantic relationship with someone who's alive is, you know, I think a feeling of like overcoming distance using technology and, you know, long distance romance, you know, that kind of a thing is definitely more relevant than ever. The pandemic was, you know, had a lot of challenges because shooting, you know, there was constant testing. We kept going down for, you know, somebody would be testing positive and they would be suddenly sidelined for 2 weeks. And the rules in British Columbia were pretty stringent, but the people were also very good about, you know, wearing their masks and trying to prevent the infection and everything.
Did it change the way like you thought about this world or you thought about the direction, you know, we're heading into as a tech obsessed society?
Well, I don't know if it like was one big thought that changed the direction of the show. I think that a TV show is more fun and relatable if you're constantly grabbing little pieces of the real world to throw into it to remind people that it's relevant. And so we're always doing that. And you know, so there it might have anything happening in the world, the pandemic included, changes the world and makes you pick different little nuggets to incorporate into the show. So there was definitely a pollination or something with the real world, but I don't think it changed the direction that much. And we were actually kind of lucky that we were already in the right direction, I think, with the story and the themes.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, you were a little prescient too, because I think over the past year, everyone's talking about a metaverse. Facebook completely, you know, reoriented itself around the idea of metaverse. Yeah. And in Upload, that's essentially what you guys have created, except it's centered on, you know, formerly dead people or digital consciousnesses. I have not finished season two yet, but I'm wondering, are you guys looking to explore the idea of, you know, normal people, living people going into a world like this and having a full metaverse experience or maybe this actual world?
Well, that is part of this. I mean, that is part of this concept. The hotel, the digital hotel that Nathan lives in, as was set up in the pilot and in episode five, the lower 5,000 floors are what they called a vacation resort, a virtual reality vacationing. And so all the people on the lower 5,000 floors are real people who are, you know, meeting their lovers or going on a vacation or something in this digital world. So it already had this sort of notion of you didn't have to be dead to participate.
Right, right.
Yeah, there's a lot of virtual reality in the show. And the funny thing is with Facebook is that some aspect of their metaverse is called Horizon. They actually named it after the company in our show. So we're leading the way for them.
It's funny, too, because we used to be a part of Verizon. So every time you guys said Horizon, it was a little tinge of...
We called it Horizon. It wanted to sound Horizon, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it hit us close to home. Last question for you. I'm really interested in the way you fleshed out the Luddite community in the show. And it's really interesting because there are degrees of people who are anti-tech. And, you know, at the most basic level, it's somebody who's very religious. Can you talk about like how you guys thought of that and how you constructed that? Are you pulling from things you're seeing in reality right now or the original Luddite movement?
Sure. Well, we pulled from a lot of things. There's two main strands of the Luddites in the show. There's a sort of a religious strand that is against Upload entirely because it seems sacrilegious. And then there's a more sort of lefty strand, which is against it if it's going to be run by capitalists and only be for rich people. And so they're looking for universal upload. And so there's these inherent contradictions in the LUD movement that are up in the woods. And there's a lot of like weird tensions going on between the different wings. And, you know, that was something that maybe you observe in a lot of sort of left-wing kind of movements, like if, like in the Spanish Civil War or something, like if they were all on the same page, they would do better. But there's all these factions and infighting. And so that was sort of an observation for that setting. And we wanted Nora to be on a journey of trying to figure out what she thinks is the proper way to set up an upload, because, you know, basically once you create a virtual world, like the world of Lakeview is created by the Horizon company, you're basically starting a new society and you're setting what the terms are and what the rules are. And if you don't thoughtfully approach it, then you're basically just saying, well, we'll just let this company do it for profit. And it's not going to necessarily benefit anybody other. It's just a money-making scheme. So Nora's on this sort of a journey to try and figure out, well, if you are going to start a new society, what should the rules be? How should you organize it? And she's, you know, getting some ideas from the LUDs, but she's going to be off, you know, thinking of her own ideas later.
Excellent. Well, I think I have time to squeeze in one more, actually. I'm just wondering, you know, working on this show is a lot raunchier than a lot of your other stuff. You know, I've been a fan of your work since The Simpsons. So you actually be able to show sex scenes and have people swear. Has that changed the way you've thought of how you'd want to pursue future projects? And even with these themes of tech, too. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'll say that I sort of wanted to do something that was going to stretch my skills after The Office went down. And that's when I pitched this. And at the time, the streamers were very much looking for the sort of Game of Thrones show, you know, that was going to be very absorptive. Is that a word?
Yeah, sure.
You know, so I sort of pitched them that this was going to be very intense. I wanted the romance to be super intense. And the the sci-fi little moments of horror. I just thought it would be it had to sort of cut through and not be a lukewarm show. And so at the time, you know, in the pilot, that we did have some sex scenes and in season one, and we are being a little more maybe risque than it was on NBC. But I don't know, the whole culture is a little more, you know, used to that, I think now. I don't think it's tasteless at any point. I think it's just trying to be, you know, trying to keep people's interest.
Yeah, it's a little more real, I'd say, right? You don't have to tone it down for TV. Well, you know what, Greg Nails, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of the season, and good luck with the launch of this season.
Thank you so much. Nice to talk to you.